Today I would like to discuss a text that has been largely overlooked in the scholarship of Victorian literature, Mary Smith's posthumously published 1892 autobiography entitled The Autobiography of Mary Smith, Schoolmistress and Nonconformist. Though ostensibly an autobiographical piece, I would like to complicate this two-dimensional characterization by presenting a reading of Smith's self-text as a modified Victorian travelogue, one in which forms of narrative structure, strategies of self-representation, and typologies of cultural and social otherness dually reflect and subvert gender conventions of 19th century travel writing. So my paper explores how well 20th and 21st century post-colonial criticism of traditional Victorian narratives applies to texts that fall outside of the normative schema of Victorian travel writing. In particular, I would like to complicate the divisions between what critics have identified as masculine and feminine forms of Victorian travelogues. So Mary Smith was neither a middle-class woman, now I realize this is debatable by what I'm about to say, but I'll come back to that in a moment. She never left the shores of England, and her travel was dictated by financial and social necessity rather than leisure or the pursuit of knowledge. She resided in each of the cities to which she traveled for several years, attaining paid work and integrating into the religious and social context of her travel destinations in a markedly different way than the more solidly middle-class travel authors of which are often written about. Now, however, Smith's narration employs many of the conventions of men and women's travel writing that critics such as Sarah Mills, Mary Louise Pratt, and Catherine Walchester identify as conventionally gendered forms of travel narration in their studies on colonial sentiment in Victorian travelogues. So Smith's autobiography is structured as a tripartite narrative around the three cities in which she resided, centering her narrative upon descriptions of what she considers to be foreign northern English landscapes and encounters with exotic social otherness she faces in Brough and Carlisle in opposition to her home in Oxfordshire. The ways in which she figures these encounters dually affirm and subvert typical travelogues by combining conventionally masculine and feminine forms of narration. So this is very much a work in progress. It stems from my Imlet dissertation, of which this was the themes of one of my chapters, and it's actually sort of an angry response to one of my markers, who ended up giving me a good mark and said, I don't know if I bought that chapter. And I was like, I buy that chapter. So I've sort of come back and revised it and seen what exactly what I can do with juxtaposing Smith's text against a post-colonial examination and against Victorian dominant Victorian travelogues, because I believe it can open up readings of her autobiography to new critical applications while expanding the parameters of traditional criticism and post-colonial applications on traditional criticism, traditional travel narrative, excuse me. So, to provide a brief theoretical background, in their reevaluations of Victorian women travel narratives, Discourse of Difference and Imperial Eyes, Sarah Mills and Mary Louise Pratt, respectively, argue that men and women's travel writing approach dominant social and political discourses, such as colonialism, from divergent social perspectives, though all these authors were typically members of an increasingly mobile middle class. Mills, in particular, utilizes post-colonial theorists such as Edward Said and Gayatri Spivak in order to trace how these differences of approach resulted in divergent expectations and methods by which men and women construct themselves in conjunction and opposition to encounter quote-unquote foreign others in their travelogues. Spivak, Said, Mills, and Pratt all gesture to a rhetoric of mastery and egotistical adventure in many men's travel narratives, a language of self-identity created at the expense of non-Western, specifically non-British, peoples and cultures. Traditional men's travel narratives frequently engage with overarching political, natural, and cultural comparisons between Britain and the visited nation. By reducing encounter peoples to their assumed visual and intellectual attributes, male travel narrators could construct a cohesive self and national identity at the expense of encountered otherness. The male narrator can be a hero, a scientific authority, or a political commentator, because these roles were merely international extensions of his domestic or his public roles domestically. Now, where men's travel narratives could claim authority through a more detached, self-referential, and scientific description, see Richard Burton's accounts of Mecca or Kipling's fictional Kim, these Mills and Pratt's gestures of women or hold that women were held to a different social and literary standard that pressured these authors to structure their narratives as if they were sentimental figures, whose experiential authority was gained through individual engagements with cultural and social otherness, an extension of the compassion and philanthropy of the angel in the house to destinations around the globe. So Mills and other critics assert that women's travelogues were structured in such a way as to emphasize feminine behaviors, such as charity and individual localized compassion, creating a generic hybrid between a traditional travelogue and a personal diary or autobiography. in order to avoid being labeled odd, eccentric, or even inappropriate by masculine publishers and the larger reading public, women's travelogues provided self-representations that attempted, to quote Mills, reintegrate these women authors within the private sphere of the public-private divide so as to throw off a pervasive sense of something rather improper in these women's behavior, end quote. For example, middle-class Isabella Bird integrates aspects of epistolary and diary forms into her travelogues as a way of downplaying the essentially unfeminine and public aspects of her travel. She spent a lot of time in the Rocky Mountains with this very sort of mountainous man, and she talks about how she had this great friendship with him, which is very odd. But she still expresses her opinions and experiences in a way that was socially acceptable. Her travelogues were widely published. Even though she eventually would become a naturalist, and in 1892 became the first woman to be admitted to the Royal Geographical Society. So though not all middle-class women and men's travel writing can be easily defined by the definitions that I've just provided, I just wanted to give a brief background to sort of the theory that I'm engaging with. And I would like to draw attention to the self-conscious crafting particular to middle-class female travel narrators, a representational style that Catherine Walchester terms as, quote, the demure post of the unprotected, end quote, in which women appear to retreat from direct statements of political or social authority. Though, as Mills' research proves, women authors equally engaged with discourses of racism and colonialism to varying degrees. It's just that the ways in which women were socially permitted to do so was markedly different from their male counterparts. So to transition back to Mary Smith's narrative, I would argue that her self-stated working-class identity sanctions her to draw from multiple discourses of traditional middle-class women's and men's travel writing, a significant reconfiguration of travelogue from a marginal class and gender position. Born in 1842 to a shoemaker and local cook in Cropperty, Oxfordshire, Smith departed from her father's household at 18 to become the helpmate of a Baptist minister and his family, who received a position in the northern cities of Brough and Carlisle. Though the position of her family, as well as her fairly continuous employment as a private tutor turned schoolmistress, can ostensibly be classified as markers of a lower middle-class social status, Smith continually asserts that her simple upbringing and precarious financial income make her a member of the working class. This purposeful alignment with a class status potentially more marginalized than one she could socially claim sanctions her to evade certain conventions of travel writing by harnessing her own otherness as a position of literary agency. Though never leaving the shores of England, Smith constructs her migrations for paid work as instances of large-scale travel for an individual and of her gender and class status. Relocating for reasons of work, and therefore survival rather than leisure, Smith exhibits a vested personal and financial interest throughout her travelogue that is unique to her class position. Writing outside of the middle class, from where most travelogues by women originated, Smith nevertheless characterizes her migration from southern to northern England through a series of panoramic landscapes, self-reflexive exegesis, and detailed evaluations of the social and cultural otherness she encounters. Her ambiguous and other class position enables her to draw from both discourses of appropriate middle-class femininity and increasingly masculinized wage labor. So, in describing her first entrance into Brough at the age of 18, Smith reflects on the ways in which she invokes both masculine and feminine conventions of Victorian travel writing. She quotes, "In this remote place, in this rigorous climate and consequent poverty, descent held the first and foremost rank," end quote. While this is a short quote, I think it actually really does show the ways in which she combines or she invokes masculine language in this instance. She provides a panoramic view of the rough northern landscape that positions her as an authoritative observer. She can textually conquer the land and the people before her through an emphasis of Brough's isolation from what can be inferred as Smith's conceptions of southern civilized society of which she's used to. Smith enacts a masculine survey, presenting a description that Mill describes as mastering the landscape it physically describes. Describing the local inhabitants as thrifty and speaking with a, quote, more limited vocabulary than her and her employers, end quote, Smith is clearly questioning the intellectual capabilities of the locals, assuming a traditional and particularly masculine division between self and other, drawing narrative authority from categorizing and descriptively containing the citizens of Brough. She's able to express such narrative authority, and in many ways masculine authority, because she is not solely defined by the conventions of her gender. She is entering Brough as a working-class woman, working-class member, as well as a woman, a social and narrative identity with few, if any, precedents in traditional travel literature. Yet, Smith quickly departs from such conventionally masculine, in many ways, one could argue, orientalist narration, as she describes an immediate sense of belonging within the community, mediated by her shared dissenting religious views with the people. She quickly transitions into a more self-conscious and engaged sentimentalist, who is concerned about her reception amongst the acquaintances in Brough. When speaking about their differences in language and vocabulary, Smith notes that the northern English villagers reacted strangely to her arrival, stating, "But had we been Eskimo, the curiosity of the younger part of the people could hardly have been greater. They talked about us in our hearing, as though they thought that we should not understand what they said. I suppose it was because they could not understand us as well." End quote. Smith is anxious about her appearance to the people of Brough. She makes herself a foreign other by comparing her party to Eskimos that are being gays, which are being gays, stating that the people of Brough could no more understand her southern accent than she could their northern one. Smith others herself while othering the people of Brough. Her narrator and the foreign individuals are figured as returning each other's gaze in her narration, as her discomfort with their language is echoed by her description of their discomfort. Smith's awkward public encounters are combined with her private apprehensions of difference, a feminine form of travel narration that counters the rhetoric of superior authorial self and subjugated other expressed just a few passages earlier. In these lines, Smith's narrator draws from feminine travel narration styles, ultimately producing an experiential account that destabilizes the boundaries between Smith's self-identity and encountered others of Brough in her narrative. Clearly, I have problems with English as well. So, to continue, she consistently vacillates between characterizing herself as a privileged observer and a sentimental figure, whose descriptions of otherness erase the discursive space between public travel and personal experience. This fluctuation is especially apparent later on in her narrative, during her lengthy sojourn in Carlisle, where she would eventually remain with few absences until her death in 1889. During her initial years in Carlisle, Smith noted that the city, quote, presented a very uncompromising aspect, end quote, and that its people were, quote, quaint, quiet, and slow, and hardly any of them habitually bright or brisk or stately or with an air of superior intelligence or breeding, end quote. Smith furthers this pretense of authoritative observation by claiming that the people of Carlisle ignored, quote, the amenities of society, end quote, by following uncouth customs of their own. Smith notes that the people of Carlisle excited her interest greatly on every hand, observation of cultural natives depicted solely through its effect upon the authorial speaker. Once again, Smith abstractly and distantly observes her encountered other without any substantial effort to decenter her personal ego from the forefront of the narrative. Just as in her description of Brough's isolated landscape, Smith, in a sense, narratively masters the people of Carlisle by claiming the normatively masculine ability to generalize and abstract them into discrete attributes. Further on in Smith's Carlisle section, however, she again shifts back into a more self-reflexive commentary on how her relation to the people of Carlisle, She actively wrote short topical pieces for local journals in and around Carlisle, many of them activists in nature on behalf of religious or social groups she felt were being discriminated against by the larger local governments. For example, she states, "I was writing on a familiar theme, how standing armies demoralize the community, one of their worst evils, and perhaps my mind was full of the subject." This statement reveals a greater level of intimacy and engagement with the culture and society of Carlisle than her previous statements. No longer is Smith dismembering the people of Carlisle into the most outward attributes, she's intricately connecting the larger, abstract issue of standing armies with the effect that issue had upon not only Carlisle, but her personally as a resident of that city and culture. Smith has shifted the narrator back into a sentimental, feminine mode of travel narration, in which philanthropy and compassion, rather than authoritative and detached evaluations of foreign societies and landscapes, are narratively centered. So Smith narrates her travel experiences from multiple social perspectives that significantly destabilize Smith's own self-identity as much as it describes the otherness of the encountered populations of northern England. At turns, she represents herself as a sentimental, appropriately feminine-speaking figure who privileges individual cultural exchanges, only to undercut such conventions of female travel writing with characterizations that fashion the narrator as a scientific observer whose descriptions of the northern English societies are less experiential, reflecting a more masculine tendency towards centering the narrator as a repository of cultural and social authority, made normative by its separateness from the foreign culture. So, what does this mean for Smith's text as a travel narrative, and how can postcolonial criticism of Victorian travelogues enrich our understanding of her particular styles of narration and self-representation? I would argue that I contend that Smith's marginal gender and socioeconomic positions as a woman who worked and a worker who was a woman allow her travel narrative to piece together different aspects of conventional men and women's travelogues, crafting a text that complexly engages in multiple discourses of women's self-representation, 19th century colonizing rhetoric, and working class adaptation of dominantly middle class literary forms. Her deployment of masculine-feminine strategies of travel narration destabilize readings of her representation of cultural otherness as either masculine or feminine, egotistical or reflexive. So whether or not you believe the postcolonial examinations can apply to domestic chronicles of travel is academically useful, I nevertheless hope that diverse and unconventional applications of modern critical theory to minor Victorian texts can support new ways of reading these texts and extend their relevance to multiple discourses of 19th century studies. So ultimately, my larger question is, what do you think about this application? I realize that it's not particularly clear or in all cases or is obvious in many, but I think that we can get some really interesting readings out of it. So thank you.